So with that very quick set of technical reminders, I believe we have walked through all of the controls that we needed to cover. And I'm going to go ahead and swap out our view here for the presentation materials. And I'll turn the floor over to Carlos Puchon, who's joining us from EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division, to begin the presentation. Carlos, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Jean, and thank you everybody for joining us today. It's a pleasure to be here to discuss this today's webinar on conducting climate vulnerability assessments at Superfund sites. It'll be myself and Sean DuBois from ICF will be doing the presentation. Do know that a lot of folks have been involved in the work that's allowed us to compile this information, provide this information, this webinar. I'd like to recognize some of the site teams of the 26 Superfund sites where we've conducted or are conducting CVAs. Colleagues of mine in headquarters, such as Jen Edwards and Vanessa Van Note, who've been instrumental in getting this whole CVA process underway. And then certainly the ICF team, their climate folks, their remedy folks, and the program support folks that have also helped us so much in getting to where we are. Today we've give me a second here to get to the slides control. Here we go. So on today's webinar, sorry, just a quick note. I meant to say I'm with the Superfund program in headquarters. Sean will be covering the CVA process itself in a few slides broke down. And if you may, Sean, I'm going to hand that off to you. I appreciate if you do a quick introduction of yourself. So in today's webinar, we've been thinking about this for quite a while now. We've been working on CVAs for approximately a year and a half, almost 2 years now. And we are learning a lot as we go along. Today's the emphasis is going to be on conducting climate vulnerability assessments. So really on the process itself of undertaking a climate vulnerability assessment at a contaminated site, our experiences at Superfund sites. But not so much on the findings and the outcome. As we'll discuss later, we are analyzing what the findings have been at the sites we've already completed the CVAs at, but it's very early still for the site teams to take action on those findings and for us to analyze them more thoroughly. However, we do not want to hold up what we know so far about conducting CVAs, so hence we have this more compressed webinar today, which is hopefully about under an hour, where we're going to cover what the process itself is about. So I'm going to briefly cover some really important framework information on considerations of climate vulnerability in the Superfund process, where our authorities are, et cetera, some very core climate concepts. That'll be very brief. And then I'll hand it over to Sean, who's going to walk us through the CVA process itself, how we went about doing it in the Superfund program as part of our efforts here to integrate climate vulnerability assessments into our site managements. We'll give you a very short discussion on lessons learned, both on CVA as well as on how that information that comes out of those CVAs can be used in the Superfund process. And then a brief introduction of the issue paper and expecting or anticipated next steps going forward, and then a moderated discussion. Okay. So the two, this is really the basic, the core climate concept slides, but I think it's important for us to ensure that everybody's aware that today we'll be talking about climate adaptation. That is a question of how is the Superfund corporate program incorporating climate change science into the implementation of its remedies. Given the knowledge that we have on how climate is changing, the question is how are we factoring that into our program? That is the basis of the climate change discussion we are having on today's webinar. There is another very important point, which is climate change mitigation, and that is how can we minimize greenhouse gas emissions generated by site cleanups. We have been working in that area for many years in Superfund and other cleanup programs in EPA through green remediation efforts. The donut, as we call it on the right, has those core elements, and you'll see that one of them is air and atmosphere. That is where we consider how greenhouse gas emissions are factored into the implementation of our remedies. And there are a lot of best management practices out there already that are being used in our programs to reduce greenhouse gas emissions associated with the cleanups. We're also finding, of course, that there are a lot of synergies between green remediation and climate adaptation. You know, good examples of BMPs that result in both are renewable energy, when we install renewable energy generating capacity on site to power our system, that not only reduces greenhouse gas emissions associated with the remedy, but also provides some additional climate resilience should there be a grid outage. We still have autonomous power at the site. Another example is green infrastructure for stormwater management. Reduces the greenhouse gas footprint associated with managing and treating all that stormwater, but it also gives us some added resilience for the site to be able to address changes or increases in precipitation intensity, et cetera. And finally, a really good one is restoration of abandoned mine lands when we're using amendments, for example, to restore vegetative cover on mineralized soil. Well, at the same time, not only are we holding that soil in place, but we're also securing some carbon sequestration in that soil and thereby mitigating greenhouse gas. So anyway, we've had some separate webinars on that topic, but do know that there are a lot of synergies between these two, but today the focus will be on climate change adaptation. Okay, next slide. So this is a climate resilience in Superfund because a lot of our experience, the work that we're doing has been in the Superfund program, but I should point out that we have also worked, done some climate vulnerabilities and are working on them at corrective action sites, also at federal facilities. And the core technical findings of this issue paper are, let's call them program neutral. It doesn't matter that the site is being cleaned up under one authority or another. Some of the technical aspects of the cleanup and the climate vulnerabilities are indifferent to the regulatory authority under which it's being conducted. So I think the findings of the issue paper are universal as far as the type of program under which the site is being cleaned up. But I do want to mention that that a lot of the work has been done under the through the Superfund program. Okay. So we have been working in this area for quite a while now in climate change adaptation. Back in 2012, when we got the first direction from policy direction from the agency and actually from the White House back then, to look at climate adaptation and how it might affect the implementation of our programs, we did do a portfolio analysis of all NPL sites at that time. And using geographic information systems, we laid them all out on a map and did a screening level assessment of what exposures they might face in inundation and sea level rise. And I think there was a third one at this point. And we did find that indeed at a portfolio level, quite a few of our remedies are exposed or could be exposed to changing climate conditions. And that information also helped us develop a strategy to start looking at future climate conditions and determining how we need to address them in the implementation of the program. That information fed into the 2014 agency climate adaptation implementation plan. And one of the findings from the 2012 analysis was that while a lot of our sites face potential climate exposures, there also was a lot of redundancy and resilience built into them. We interviewed quite a few of the sites that we thought were like quote unquote worst case scenarios and found that a severe weather, for example, changing or increasing floods, et cetera, had already been factored into the remedy design, construction, and operation. And a lot of that played out in 2017 when five major hurricanes hit the southeastern United States, and EPA regions 2, 4, and 6 were all hit by Category 5 or similar hurricanes. There were 250 sites, national priority list sites, that were affected by either tropical force winds or inundation. Yet we found, working with the regions, our peers in the regions, as part of the engineering reform effort, which we'll describe in a second, we found that none of the sites, while they did face damage, buildings, infrastructure, et cetera, none of them had site remedy protectiveness issues. That told us that empirically, it showed what we had discussed earlier, that a lot of redundancies are built into our program and the implementation of our remedies. However, we acknowledge that climate is changing and we want to ensure that that resilience continues to exist going forward. So a little bit further down the pipeline in 2019, the Government Accountability Office had an inquiry on this topic of potential exposure of NPL sites to climate change. A lot of the recommendations were consistent with what we had already done. A couple of them we acted on, including issuing an Olin directive specifying our authorities, which I'll discuss in just a minute, and what actions need to be taken to ensure continued protectiveness of our remedies under changing climate conditions. So that directive was issued in 21. We'll talk about it in just a second. And then finally, the directive also identified the need to document and codify how we do climate vulnerability assessments. And that's what this webinar is about. And that effort of CBAs and how to do them is also part of the Olin Climate Adaptation Implementation Plan, which was released in October 22. So this information that we're sharing with you is, in a sense, a part of that plan as well. Okay, so let me go to the next slide. So the memo I mentioned previously was issued in 2021, June 30th, 2021, by our current Superfund Office Director, Larry Duchamp. And main point to make is that one of the things the memo identifies is the authority that we have under CERCLA, the law through which Superfund operates, to consider future climate conditions as part of our remedy decision, selection, et cetera, is one of the 9 criteria under which remedies are selected in Superfund. The 9 criteria include one which is long-term protectiveness. Remedies selected for, in the Superfund process, one of the considerations is that they're protective in the long term. And that's basically the anchor for considering climate change. If in the life of the remedy, conditions are going to change in a manner that it is no longer protective, our selection would be inconsistent with our authorities in the CERCLA. So that is the anchor under which we look at future climate conditions to ensure that that protectiveness is going to continue. And that's what this webinar is about, how we go about doing that. So let's go into a little bit more detail of those questions that derive from that one I just mentioned. The basic question in Superfund, and I was saying, any cleanup program that's going to have a remedy that's going to be active for a long time with respect to adaptation is, how is climate change likely to affect the protectiveness of my remedy? And what actions do I need to take to ensure resilience under future climate conditions? That is, I think those key questions, how is protectiveness, how might protectiveness be affected, and what actions do I need to take to ensure I have continued resilience in those future conditions? So that is the core question. It is climate change. What is the change in climate conditions? And I underline change because climate is already factored into our decision-making process. As we heard earlier, when we did the portfolio analysis back in 2012, and when we experienced 3 sequential significant hurricanes in the southeastern United States, we learned that indeed severe weather conditions based on historic records are already being factored into the selection, design, and operation of our remedies. And empirically found that they are resilient, the protectiveness is resilient to those conditions. But will that resilience continue under future conditions? Because we've always used historic records. So that is a question. What does forward-looking climate analysis tell us about future conditions at our site? Is there a delta? Is there a significant change in future conditions over historic conditions? Because if conditions don't, there's no indication that they're going to change, then we can use historic records to inform our decision-making process. But if there is a significant delta in the future conditions, how does that delta affect remedy decisions at site operations? So these are the 3 key questions we are asking about climate change through our climate vulnerability assessment process. Okay, let me go to the next slide. So I want to point out that this question is not unique to headquarters. We have worked collaboratively with our other cleanup programs in Olin, or the land office and EPA here in Washington, D.C. And we've also looked closely at the climate change adaptation plans developed by all 10 regions, 10 EPA regions. And we found that really there were at least 10 different regions plans specifically identify the need or to develop tools and knowledge on conducting climate vulnerability assessments. So hopefully this process that we're describing today will not only meet our unique needs here in Superfund, but also those of other programs and regions across EPA. So as was mentioned in the Osready memo regarding consideration of climate change in the Superfund program, and adaptation. We undertook this effort, established capacity in headquarters to support the regions, and developed the process to integrate that knowledge into how we conducted climate vulnerability assessments. So we've worked collaboratively with the engineering forum, as we have for many years in many areas. The goal of the engineering forum is to foster exchange of up-to-date information on related to engineering remediation issues in both EPA and corrective action program. And they've been involved again with us, and we've been involved, work together in advancing both green remediation and climate change adaptation. For example, we've teamed up for delivery of 5 training for manager conferences, our big EPA Supercom conferences. So we've worked quite a bit together. And this issue paper is a product of that collaboration. Again, it summarizes lessons learned to date in conducting climate vulnerability assessments at 26 sites. We actually worked on quite a few more sites because we did some what are called portfolio assessments of 5-year reviews. So it's closer to 50 sites where we've been we've conducted assessments similar to this one. So this the issue paper focuses on the process applied to date at all these sites. Next slide. So I want to mention that it's an important point of performing a climate screening. As the title suggests, this is a climate vulnerability assessment. It includes consideration of the consequences of potential exposure, but it is based on a climate screening, which will be a part of it. Climate screening, what we would do is look at potential future climate exposures using publicly available screening tools. And that's an important point I want to emphasize a little bit further ahead. We'll then look at the remedy that's at a site and consider the time frame. Will the life of the remedy overlap with those climate projections? And assess qualitatively the sensitivity of the remedies to the climate hazard projections that projected at the site. So if we see there's a possible intersection, then we might conclude that either there is no issue, the climate changes are not that significant, or the lifespan of the remedy will end before those changes occur, or the remedy is not sensitive to those changes. We might consider that we're done. However, if we do see an intersection between those three, we might consider a full climate vulnerability assessment. So acknowledge the very important point of what a climate screening can do, and it is probably going to be a lead up to a climate vulnerability assessment. But a majority of the sites do not need a climate vulnerability assessment. Let me be clear about that. We're not proposing a climate vulnerability assessment for every contaminated site cleanup. Only those where a previous climate screening indicates that we may need to take additional action and better understand what the vulnerabilities are. So a very important point, not every site needs a climate vulnerability assessment. However, if we do determine that there's an indication that there might be an issue with remedy effectiveness, that's when we want to undertake a climate vulnerability assessment, which is the process outlined in the issue paper we're releasing today. In this issue paper, and Sean will go into more detail about this, we're going to look at exposure, how are climate conditions changing? We'll look at sensitivity, how does it protect against that remedy? How might it be affected by those changing climate conditions? And then determine whether the adaptive capacity is already there to handle it. If not, we'd make propose some considerations for adapting the site to those changing climate conditions, which is basically what this figure tells us. Right now, we're focusing on exposure and sensitivity to determine what its vulnerability is. Based on that, we might propose a series of adaptation measures, which would then be prioritized by the site team and implemented and reviewed going forward. Important point here, we have conducted CBAs at sites at every phase of the quote-unquote pipeline from remedial investigation feasibility study all the way to 5-year reviews. And just a note, at every point along the way, there's an opportunity to take action going forward to address potential climate vulnerabilities. Important point, in no CBA have we found a relatively imminent or severe protectiveness issue at our site. Okay, let's go to the next slide. So we noted in the webinar and registration, very, very interesting mix of participants. Thank you all for being here today. We have peers in EPA, consulting engineering firms, state co-regulators, other federal agencies, universities. I'm sure that quite a few of you have been conducting climate vulnerability assessments or similar processes of your own. And a question we have, we're really interested in this, and we'll discuss this a little bit further on. If you could tell us, for those of you who have been doing either screening or a climate vulnerability assessment, what is your greatest challenge when addressing climate concerns at your site? So we've laid out five options here, and we ask that you go ahead and submit these. It's either knowing which climate data to use, doing the climate projection going forward, applying the climate exposure to your site to understand what the sensitivities are, or developing and implementing adaptation measures. Please select one and submit it. And Jean, I think, will help us pop it up. And that will help us focus a little bit of our conversation going forward. Thanks, Jean.
Excellent. Thank you. So, ladies and gentlemen, you should see a pop-up window on your screen allowing you to vote or respond to this question. If you don't see it, please look for the three dots or more menu on Zoom. And worst case, if you can't find the poll, that's okay. We've put the question here on the slide, and you are absolutely welcome to simply type your response into the Q&A. Once you've shared your response, either by clicking the circle on the poll window, please hit that submit button. Of note, for those of you who are selecting the last option of other, we welcome you to share more specific explanation of what your other response is by typing a message into the Q&A. So, Andy, you have some concerns with getting your clients to take climate considerations seriously. That's exactly. For those of you who are picking other, please go ahead and share your specific response in that Q&A. Again, for those of you who can't see the poll window, you can just type your response directly into the Q&A window. Carlos, it looks like about two-thirds of the audience have responded. Remember, there's no right or wrong answer. We're just getting an assessment of what you're facing, your specific greatest challenge. I'll give you all just a few more seconds now to consider and then set your answer in on the poll before we take a step back and look at those responses. So I'm going to go ahead and end this poll here in 3, 2, 1, and sharing those results. So, Carlos, as I look at the 70% of the attendees who voted, it appears as though about a third of them indicated that projecting future climate considerations for their site, so sort of knowing what criteria to use for various climate exposures, is the number one or the greatest challenge. But not far behind that was applying climate exposure findings to their site and then understanding the remedy sensitivities. In terms of what I'm seeing here in the Q&A, a number of people have chimed in echoing Andy's response on getting their clients or their customer to take the climate consideration seriously. But we also have people noting how to justify paying for that adaptation to address the predicted change. We go on to see other ones that considering the appropriate window to consider the climate impact. So that time frame when they may start to see those impacts. So again, making it even more difficult to then carry on and say this is important if they can't even figure out when or clearly define when it may impact them, and then getting them to pay for that then just follows on as a further compounding issue. So I do want to thank everyone for sharing that. I'm seeing other ones, how to estimate the interactions between climate and chemical exposure, how to interpolate the climate predictions generated by climate models. So what do they mean when they say days with greater than 2 inches of precipitation increased by half a day? So just working with the data that they have available.
Great. Thank you very much, Jean. Those are excellent. I hope we will be able to tackle some of them with Sean's item now. I should say that I think we have moved forward because earlier on when we started, the core question was, what climate data model should I use? That is no longer the main priority, and we agree with that. There's a lot of publicly available tools now, so that is very helpful. I've been looking at those responses while Sean covers his material. But at this point, in order to keep on schedule, I need to hand this off to I believe that's where we are, Sean. I'm going to hand that off to you. And if you could introduce yourself and acknowledge the rest of your team. Oh, we do have some questions. Sorry.
It might not be a bad time for Sean to introduce himself because he may help with some of these questions. So Sean, go ahead and then we'll take a couple of questions here.
Thank you, Carlos. Yes, my name is Sean Dubois. I'm with ICF. Our team here at ICF, comprised of climate experts and remediation experts, has assisted Carlos and EPA headquarters in developing the CVA process and applying it at Superfund sites, as Carlos mentioned, 26 sites through fiscal year 2023. So I'll go ahead and go into the process that we've used for performing these climate vulnerability assessments, but are there any questions, Carlos, you want to address based off of that poll or that have come through, or would you like to move forward with my section and address questions afterwards?
Gene, I think we're a bit short on time, but if any questions are
Yeah,
asked.
just one. There seem to be a few people asking about a statement that you made. You said the majority of sites do not need a CVA, only those with what? Several people are asking, are these
Right.
required? Are all the programs doing them? So could you just provide a clarification on when we're doing CVAs?
Correct. So the CVAs that we are doing are based on the site teams that have come forward to us, and because they made a previous determination that they felt they needed a climate vulnerability assessment. What we are doing is encouraging that a screening be conducted first. I discussed it briefly, and there is a section in the CVA guidance on how to do a climate screening of your site. If there's an indication that there's a potential protectiveness issue going forward based on future climate conditions, then we recommend undertaking the full CVA, which would help address some of those questions that have been raised. For example, is the cost benefit of the increased protectiveness provided by adaptation worth it? When might, at what rate, or when might that change occur? Some of those questions would be better answered having a full CVA on hand. So thank you for that.
All right, thank you. And just a real quick clarification, are any of the CVAs posted publicly? I know that you were pointing out several resources, so some attendees are looking for copies of CVAs that they could read.
No, they're not ready available, publicly available, but we will discuss the follow-on to this webinar toward the end, where we hope to describe those the findings of the CVAs in more detail.
All right. Thank you. I think we'll carry on with the next part of the presentation, but just a gentle reminder to the attendees who have joined us, please go ahead and continue to submitting your comments and questions in the Q&A. We'll pause again in just a few moments for another Q&A break, but you can keep those questions and comments coming in. Sean, I believe we'll turn the floor to you.
Thank you, Jean. So just want to show here quickly again that diagram that Carlos had put up earlier, the CVA process that's been used at Superfund sites. I'll be going into some of these steps in a little more detail, but please write questions down and know that the issue paper covers these steps in a lot more detail. I want to point out here that the process is not necessarily a linear progression through these steps. In particular, results from the climate exposure inform remedy sensitivity analysis, and vice versa. The importance of specific impacts to the remedy might impact or might suggest what climate exposure parameters should be reviewed. So, step one is the engagement and scoping. And this, I think, answers some of those questions you have in regards to what sites need a CVA. And sort of what we've seen are sites that have been screened and there was a determination made that additional analysis was needed. More and more EPA regions have been performing their own screenings and identifying and prioritizing sites that would benefit from a CVA. Additionally, sites with remedies in a climatologically dynamic environment. Certainly, climate is changing everywhere. But certain sites and certain remedies are in environments that may be particularly susceptible. For example, we see a lot of sites in coastal areas because of sea level rise, near floodplains, and environments like that that raise more questions in regards to how might climate change impact my remedy. And then finally, there's the need for documentation of remedy resilience to address community or other site stakeholder concerns. Sites with a very invested community group have used the CVA report to answer questions regarding how climate change will be addressed for this specific site. This first step allows for engagement between the group performing it, so remedy experts, climate experts, EPA headquarters, site manager, and regional technical staff. To have initial conversations about concerns regarding climate, and then tailor the assessment to fit the site needs. Again, it's a collaborative effort, and this initial scoping step with the engagement with the site team really helps make sure that the results from the CVA are beneficial and usable by the site team. So step two has been performing the climate exposure. The climate exposure analysis identifies the projected changes in climate conditions that the site may experience. Again, it's tailored to the site, and there's a number of points here to consider when performing this step to ensure the data is usable and beneficial for the site. The time frame. There's a couple questions in regards to the time frame that should be considered when performing this step, the climate exposure step. And this again goes into how it's important to understand the remedy sensitivity and how that will feed into the climate exposure. So for example, what is the time frame of the remedy? Is waste going to be left at the site in perpetuity? And therefore you might look at the longest time frame available for certain data sources. That might be end of century, or for example, a pump and treat system that has an anticipated lifespan of 30 years. You might focus on projections for mid-century. And also looking at different climate projection scenarios. The figure on the right of this slide shows different emission scenarios of greenhouse gases and the impact that it will have on global mean temperature. So anywhere from a low emission scenario, which includes abating greenhouse gas emissions, to high emission scenarios where there's no policy to restrict emissions of greenhouse gases. And that's through CMIP-5, categorized as RCP 8.5. For our CVAs, we have used RCP 8.5, this more worst-case scenario, to make sure we're capturing all vulnerabilities that could potentially occur at a site. Data sources. There's a number of data sources out there. It's worth a conversation with some climate experts, if they're available, to talk through what data is best for my site. And then looking at the image on the right, what we've often used are these LOCA downscaling data, where we are able to get very precise, high resolution climate data that is most applicable to a site. So instead of the figure on and this is showing topography, if you were considering topography of California and Nevada, looking at very large grid cells might not really tell you what's going on in a specific area. Using that downscaled data gives you high resolution data that will be most applicable to the site. Again, we've talked about the climate hazards that should be looked at. This again is tailored to the site. And then finally, the output of the analysis, whether it's charts, maps, figures, how to convey this information to the site team and best assist in determining vulnerabilities for a site. So we have a poll here. What climate hazards are a concern for contaminated sites you have worked on? Temperature, precipitation and or drought, sea level rise, inland flooding, wildfire, or other. Please enter your response into the Q&A.
All right, Sean. So just as with the previous poll, there should be a new pop-up. In this case, though, it's a multiple choice, meaning that you can select multiple options from that list. So feel free to check off the box to the left of any or all answers that apply to this question for you, and then hit the submit button. For those of you that select the last option for other, we do ask that you share a clarification of what your other is by submitting a message into the Q&A. If for any reason you can't see that pop-up poll window, you're certainly welcome to just simply manually type your response in the Q&A. And I'm starting to see some of those clarifications and responses coming in. About two-thirds of the audience have voted on this. Remember, there's no right or wrong answer. Again, we're just learning more about you and the issues that you're facing on your sites. So I'll give you all just a few more seconds here to consider the question and share your responses. And I'll close this one out here in 3, 2, 1. And let's look at those results. So as I'm scrolling through here, Sean, it does look like precipitation or drought was the top response at about two-thirds of those who responded. But not far behind, at almost 60% of the respondents, they indicated inland flooding. So those two, and then sea level rise was also up there. So those three seem to be the top concerns at their sites. As I scroll through the Q&A, some of the attendees shared some additional responses that they have concerns about storm surges, groundwater emergence, high winds, including tornadoes and hurricanes, mobilization of contaminants, and then melting of permafrost.
Great, thank you. I think that leads in nicely to the list of example data sources here. As you mentioned, there's sometimes site-specific issues in terms of permafrost that's not applicable nationwide that need to be tailored given the site need. Additionally, changes in groundwater level might depend on, or you might look at that depending on if there's groundwater contamination or subsurface contamination that will be left at the site long term. And so this is just an example list here. And again, there might be other hazards and variables that are necessary to include given specific site needs. So here's some examples of the climate exposure analysis, ranging from the use of charts and maps to show potential changes in climate. So the figure on the left is showing potential change in the 24-hour storm intensity for various return intervals, everything from a 5-year, 1 in 5-year storm to a 1 in 100-year storm, and how that might change. And looking at how these changes relate to recent historical storms can be helpful as well. For example, here, this site was in an area that was impacted by the San Carlos storm earlier this year, and plotting the totals associated with that storm and then thinking about how the site might have been impacted from a storm like that, and then considering how climate change might make storms like that more frequent, can help in determining the sensitivity and vulnerability of remedies at a site. Also showing future sea level rise, you might look at the specific time frame that's useful for your remedy, whether that's mid-century or late century. And then also the figure on the bottom right, looking at future water table depth. Again, depending on the type of waste and remedies at a site, you might need to look at data like this. And this data source is unique only to California. However, these different tools are being updated all the time and potentially might be available in different areas of the country. So being able to communicate with people that know this data can help identify what exact climate exposure parameters you need to look at for your site. The next step is remedy sensitivity and vulnerability. So sensitivity is the degree to which a climate hazard impacts remedy protectiveness. This step is often performed in tandem with the climate exposure. As I mentioned, specific variables may be added to the assessment depending on the sensitivities of the remedy. So communication between the site team, remediation experts, and climate experts can help tailor the assessment to best suit site needs. So we have a figure here showing this remedy vulnerability as this cross-section between climate exposure and remedy sensitivity. And as you can see, a remedy with a high sensitivity and a high climate exposure would result in a potentially high vulnerability. Meanwhile, you know, a low sensitivity to a climate exposure that has minimal change would result in a low vulnerability to climate change for that specific remedy. So some examples of vulnerability that we've seen at certain sites that we performed a CVA at. For example, the increases in precipitation amount associated with a 100-year storm is quite common, as we saw on that one figure a couple slides ago. Say you're at a site that has a leachate collection system that was designed to withstand a historic 100-year storm. Potential increases to the 100-year storm event may result in that leachate treatment system no longer being protective during such events. Additionally, increases in wildfire hazard and heavy precipitation events may increase landslide susceptibility and the potential for debris flows, threatening critical infrastructure at a site. An example for that would be a groundwater pump and treat system used for containment is damaged and requires lengthy repairs or replacements, resulting in loss of pollutant capture and potentially impacting remedy protectiveness. Other pieces to consider include the, as I mentioned, the relevant climate projection timeframe. Going back to the above examples for the leachate collection system associated with the site where waste is left in place, you would want to look at the longest time frame available. So comparing climate change to baseline conditions for end of century, whereas a pump and treat system where remedial goals are anticipated to be achieved in 30 years, you would focus in on mid-century projections for wildfire and extreme precipitation. Finally, depending on the site and the surrounding area, there may be ancillary systems that should be considered. For example, regional water management. In addition to potential decreases in infiltration of local aquifers, extended drought conditions could increase regional water demand, resulting in greater groundwater pumping rates and therefore additional decrease to groundwater levels, which would impact plume capture success and potentially require modification of pumping and monitoring wells. Step four, adaptation measures. As Carlos mentioned, significant redundancies are already designed into Superfund remedies, and so the CVA needs to both identify the existing adaptation measures for use in discussing with site stakeholders how you are addressing climate change and evaluate adaptive capacity to determine if the existing adaptation measures are sufficient for the future change. And then finally, assess options and considerations for additional measures to ensure the remedy will continue to be protective even with the projected changes in climate conditions. All right, and then the final steps, 5 and 6, revolve around communicating results. And very important, you've put all this effort into a CVA. How do you ensure that the results can be used by the site team? So the preliminary results presentation offers time to clearly describe the climate data and model assumptions, existing understanding of the site and remedy, and initial assessment and vulnerabilities, and then even potential adaptation measures. This once again is an important step for engagement between the RPM and the site team and with the remediation and climate experts. This preliminary presentation allows for feedback onto the assessment that would be incorporated into the final report. And the report lays out the scope of the assessment, all assumptions and climate parameters used, the description of the remedy and actions in place or planned for the site, and then provides a description of vulnerabilities and considerations for adaptation measures to pertain protectiveness under the projected climate scenarios. All right, I think we might have time for a brief question or two.
Okay, Sean, we did just have a few quick clarifications. And one of them was a simple acronym you used, or I believe it might have even been Carlos who talked about sources of data. One of them was LOCA, L-O-C-A. Can you explain what that acronym stands for?
Yes, LOCA is an acronym for Localized Constructed Analogs. And this goes back to the point about identifying data sources that are of the highest resolution for your site. So global climate models are typically at a coarse resolution, but in order to determine specific impacts at the site level, we typically use this LOCA downscale data to get higher resolution data that is more useful for assessing site impacts.
Okay. When conducting the CVAs, are there sort of standard scenarios that you're including? We have an attendee who was interested if there's an emission scenario that would be considered standard assumption at sites.
Yes, we'll probably have more time to talk about this in the discussion later on, and we do have our climate expert here to answer some of these more technical questions. But quickly, we've been using RCP 8.5, that's the high emission scenario, the worst case scenario, to make sure that we're capturing all potential vulnerabilities for a site. CMIP-6 has just come out, and that uses slightly different terminology for each scenario. But again, we are using the high emissions scenario, even with the new CMIP-6 data.
Okay. And this is the question that typically pops up. You might not be able to answer this one. We may put it on the shelf for later, but there are some attendees who are interested on the typical cost for a CVA. They're just looking for order of magnitude expenses on what this type of analysis might cost.
I don't know if Carlos wants to answer that question or if we want to.
I would say, yeah, there's no typical cost. I would say there might be a median, so not an average, but a median might be around $15,000. Some of these are done really quick, do a screening, determine there is no issue. Others, very large, very complex sites where there are multiple remedies in place and multiple potential climate exposures, especially assessing the remedy vulnerability might take a lot more effort as we get higher and higher resolution, both on the modeling and on the vulnerability assessment. But I would say a median is probably around what we've been investing is around $15,000.
Right. Thank you. I do see some other questions, but these are more process oriented in terms of how things are comparing to other elements in the Superfund process, and they might warrant a more longer discussion. So I think if it's okay with you and Sean, Carlos, we'll go ahead and carry on to the next section, but we'll pause again later. So for the audience, thank you so much with the questions and comments. Please keep sending them in. We do have additional time for another Q&A break, so please send those questions and comments in. We'll break again shortly. So Carlos and Sean, I'll turn the floor back to you.
John, all yours.
Thank you. So the next section, we'll want to spend about 10 minutes talking about some of the key lessons learned from applying this process at Superfund sites. So this first point we want to make answers some of those questions that we were just receiving in regards to the emission scenarios to use. And again, the importance of using that high emission scenario in order to capture all potential vulnerabilities. So specifically, that is RCP 8.5, and then using also the 90th percentile of model projections. And again, these assumptions are clearly laid out in a report so that anyone reading it understands that this is worst case scenario projections, but it allows us when determining potential vulnerability to ensure we've really captured everything. Furthermore, we'll provide more median projections. So that would be RCP 4.5, 50th percentile, that sort of middle range projection, so that when a site team is looking at the potential impacts and might be designing to climate change, they can sort of use that risk-based decision-making to determine what projection might be worth designing to and ensuring resilience to. And that all just depends on the specifics of the site, what might be the impact of a loss of remedy protectiveness. So that figure on the left is showing that or explaining what that sort of middle range percentile means between 10th percentile, 90th percentile. So we've been using the high estimate to ensure we're capturing all potential vulnerabilities, and that figure on the right, again, showing that range of future climate projections going from a 10th percentile of something like RCP 4.5, which is moderate emissions, up to 90th percentile of RCP 8.5. And again, this can be a pretty large range, but providing this information supports the site team in that risk-based decision-making. And in talking with the site teams that we've worked with, there's really been three key objectives of the CVA report, answering the typical needs of the site manager and the question, what do I get out of a climate vulnerability assessment? So one, as part of communicating these technical results, is distilling the climate data into meaningful results for a site. We've heard many times the site teams don't want to just get a report filled with climate data. As you've seen, it can get very technical. It's important to, of course, provide the technical information, but then lead into the results answering what does this climate data mean for my site, and then pulling that into how these specific impacts will potentially affect remedy protectiveness. And then finally, providing the considerations for improving adaptive capacity. So maybe there's a vulnerability there. What do I do with it? Having the explanation within the report about what steps may be taken to ensure protectiveness and prevent against some of these climate impacts has been very useful for the site team. And then going into the next bullet here, informing the next step. So taking that information, what do you do next? Incorporating that into the site strategy and into the CSM, depending on where you are in the remedy phase, that might be the most important step, is taking the climate information, incorporating that into your CSM, so that when you get to remedy design and might include site modeling, you can include the future projections and ensure that you are considering all potential climate impacts in these more technical steps of the Superfund process. Additionally, the report has been used to negotiate with responsible parties. I think we had a question earlier about how you are able to get your client or responsible party on board. And so having a report that lays out all of the climate information, the existing understanding of the remedy and potential sensitivities and vulnerabilities and options for improving adaptive capacity can be helpful in that negotiations process. And again, as we had mentioned, it's been very helpful in providing this information to stakeholders and in community outreach to show that climate change is being considered for the site and steps are underway to ensure the remedy will be protective, even with these, even under these more worst case scenarios.
Okay, thank you, Sean. I'll take it these for the next few slides. So this is a question that came up repeatedly in one of the a CDA throughout the life of a site in this Superfund program or elsewhere. How do I use the findings, the information that comes out of it? So I mentioned earlier that we've seen that there's value in of the CDA findings to be applied throughout the process. So for example, if we're early on, in the case of Superfund, if it's remedial investigation feasibility study, as we're still trying to figure out what options we have to put a remedy in place to protect human health and environment. You know, there are a couple of points. One, a CBA might find that there are, let's say, exposure pathways that do not exist today that may exist in the future. A classic example, which was raised in one of the questions, is groundwater. Groundwater is currently very low. Vapor intrusion is not an issue. But if we see a trend that's in precipitation patterns, et cetera, that is raising that groundwater level, might vapor intrusion be an issue in the future when it's not an issue now? So we might factor in that future scenario in our remedial investigation. Or in the feasibility study, we might determine that there's a remedy here that provides protectiveness that we need under current conditions, but in the future climate conditions, it may cost a lot or may be a different scenario. So we may decide to screen that remedy out because of questions about its protectiveness in the future climate conditions. At the record of decision level, if we are writing a record of decision, we've made our decision what a remedy is going to be, we've identified some climate vulnerabilities, we don't necessarily have to eliminate that, but we may, that option, but we may flag it in the record of decision saying, hey, when we go to design phase, consider these future conditions and design the remedy in a manner that is protective of those future climate conditions. Same situation in remedy design. Maybe such language is not included in the record of decision, but we're still looking at long-term protectiveness. We're designing a remedy. We've conducted a CDA. For example, we might, you know, look at future precipitation patterns and determine that the stormwater management infrastructure that's being put in place now may not be capable of handling those future conditions. So we may upgrade that the stormwater management capability that's associated with the infrastructure at the site needed to keep the remedy protected. So that's an example of how it'd be factored into the design. And then finally, in operating remedies, we discussed the 5-year reviews earlier on. If I am coming up to 5-year review for a site and I conduct the CBA and determine that there are significant climate-related exposures maybe occurring in the future, we don't have to take immediate action, but if we've done the screening, we may require a full CBA And may request that for the next five-year review that the CBA findings, including indications of what adaptation measures need to be taken, be prepared so we can put those in place. And finally, community engagement. Sean touched on that a little bit, but there's value for CBA in working with the community at both early and later on. So early on, for example, if we're pre-decision and we want to work with the community on making an assessment of what the reasonably anticipated future land use is at their site, well, let's make sure that future climate conditions are factored in that process and envisioning what the future land use is. But if we're later on, they want to know what remedy have in place, a CBA might help inform what scenarios we anticipate the site might be exposed to and what adaptation measures are in place or are being put in place. So definitely important for that purpose as well, and an opportunity to use the findings there. So overall, I want to summarize some of the key takeaways from these 26 plus sites at which we have been conducting CBAs. One, and I mentioned this earlier, is the importance of not reinventing the wheel. Early on in the process, especially when we were doing the portfolio assessment back in 2012, the question was, where do I get this climate data? Where do I get models that are downscale for locusts that I can use at my site and are not just, you know, hemispheric assessment? So climate tools are available. Help is available in using them. The key point here is let's make the best use of the tools that are available. Let's ask the right questions of those tools rather than creating new tools. Let's focus on extracting information from them to inform our decisions. A second one, I've hit this a few times, it's never too early or too late to conduct a climate vulnerability assessment. It can be used very early on, as well as at the back end of a remedy decision. But this certainly is a sweet spot. If you catch it at the remedial investigation feasibility study, the findings of the CBA can be factored into subsequent decisions. It's always easier than backing in or retroactively putting in adaptive measures. When it comes to CBA findings, definitely a common theme, and I've suggested this throughout several points in today's presentation, is that often they are not game changers. There's a lot of redundancy built into the program, and climate is already factored in. It's not like we never thought of climate. We do use historic records to determine what extremes, for example, exposures the site may face. So it's not like we never thought of it. What a projection will do is tell you what the trends are going forward, and substantiate a rationale for making adaptation changes. It goes a little bit to one of the questions I've noted or mentioned earlier about, you know, justifying the cost of an adaptive measure. Well, a CBA finding will help indicate, you know, what the relative probability is of facing those situations and the consequences of it. So they help substantiate decisions to implement adaptive measures, but rarely, and I didn't mention this earlier, but in all my work I've done, I've never seen a remedy change because of changing climate conditions, although we have seen quite a few adaptation measures put in place. And that is a final one. I've said it, Will, that vulnerability analyses can identify adaptation measures that are already in place. Yes, those are quite common. They may not be called climate change adaptation measures. They may be called something else, like stormwater management. But often they're overdimensioned to address extremes. The question is that redundancy is going to be sufficient for future conditions? And that's where CBAs can help to ensure, again, that redundancy continues to exist and that the protectiveness continues to exist going forward. So we're near the end now. As I mentioned, the issue paper is now available. The link to it is at the bottom of the page. We also have a series of profiles of how adaptation measures have been implemented at Superfund sites, and we'll continue to add case studies. As I mentioned, going forward, the CBAs are all still very new. Most site teams have only received them within the last year or less. There's been no time to take action on them, but we are watching these closely and working with the site teams, and we hope to have a follow-up webinar that focuses on the findings of CBAs and how what actions are taken based on those findings. But we do not want to hold up this first part, which is what our experience has been conducting CBA. So hence why we divided it up into two parts. So stay on the lookout. TechDirect is definitely a great tool to stay current on what's happening, but expect that within 2024, we'll have a follow-up webinar that focuses on the findings of the CBA rather than the CBA process itself. Okay, so with that, I think we have, Jean, do we have time some for a few questions? I think we're doing.
We do. We
Okay.
do. So the first thing that I wanted to just acknowledge, some of the participants are sharing resources in their own states or from other organizations. So I just wanted to comment on that. For example, Washington State's current cleanup regulation, their revisions that will go into effect in January of 24, they did state that it incorporates climate change vulnerability and environmental justice into their RIFS process, and they shared a link with us to that. And the Washington Department of Ecology has also prepared a remediation sustainability guidance for their site managers to use, and they prepared a link to that. So I will share those resources with our organizers, and then we'll review and include appropriate ones as resources after today's session. That does follow in suit with a question we received earlier. And Carlos, I'm not sure if you can talk a bit about any other state agencies that might be conducting. Clearly, Washington State is addressing this with some of their guidance, but are you aware of any other states that are doing this type of assessments at their sites?
No, I will acknowledge the guidance important. This is what we're releasing today. It's not guidance. It's a technical issue paper on conducting climate vulnerability assessments. But that said, I will acknowledge that ITRC has released related guidance, but it captures the concept of climate change adaptation, incorporates it into a bigger process, which includes green remediation and others. However, there are several reasons for which we were not a part of that effort. But mostly in this case, we want to segregate out the specific question of remedy protectiveness and how it might be affected by future climate conditions and what action needs to be taken to ensure its continued protectiveness. But there are state agencies that are doing work in this area. I appreciate Washington State, what we have submitted and sent us. We'll definitely be keeping an eye out for further guidance from other states related to adaptation to make sure we compile that as well. Thank you.
All right, excellent. And we may circle back to some of the topics here in just a moment. So I do recognize sometimes we bring up a question and then the attendees start responding with their own information. For example, I do have a clarification that the DTSC in California also has draft guidance that will bring this work to the table in that state. So we may come back with some other states that are doing this type of work or have some of our other panelists comment. So I want to thank you. The attendees can keep sharing their related guidance if they have one from their own organization. But let's go
Sorry,
to an,
Jean.
yeah.
If I may, just on that, and thank you for the DTSC point. That's really, really helpful. So one of the things Sean mentioned and I want to reiterate is that quite often, not only is there regulatory guidance with respect to consideration of climate change, but there are also really valuable regional, geographically based tools for a CBA. Sean mentioned the groundwater one in California. There's also the COSMOS, correct? From with respect to storm surge. And there are also, for example, some more local models. One of the big challenges that we've identified, and we're not there yet, we're working with our groundwater forum here in EPA as well, is that question of how do future climate conditions translate into changes in groundwater behavior? That is, fate, transport, chemistry. That is a very complex question. But rising sea level will affect, fresh water will float up on it. What does that mean for groundwater chemistry, flow, et cetera? And there are a lot of really good resources available regionally, geographically, regionally, and certainly California is one of them. Sean, I'm not sure if you want to expand at all on that, but I appreciate DTSC's input.
Yeah, there's a number of tools available, as Carlos mentioned. The issue paper does provide an example list of data sources, both for climate hazards and some of these more generalized tools that can be used in a screening. Again, it's not a comprehensive list, but it does provide a good place to start in terms of potential data sources and tools that can be used to help in the screening and performing of a climate vulnerability assessment.
Okay. Our next topic we'll move on to is the 5-year review process. A number of participants have asked if you could clarify how the CVA compares to climate change analysis done through the 5-year review process. One of them specifically wanted to know, does the CVA identified risk get added to Section 5 in that technical assessment question in a 5-year review?
Yeah, we're going to have specific questions about how to act on the finding, be dealt with the regional, with the regional project manager or the five review coordinator in the respective region. But the five-year review, there it identifies climate change as a potential consideration in the protective reserve remedy. It does not tell you how to do a climate vulnerability assessment. So the CVA is in a sense a response to that. To that question in five-year reviews about has new information, for example, become available that may question the protective reserve remedy. And I think there's a five-year review guidance, some more specific, for example, in EPA Region 2, but even in the National Superfund Program, Renewal Program guidance, there are examples of climate considerations that may factor in. What a CBA does is gives you a mechanism to assess the scale of that, of how the relevant and relevance of that changing information. How you act on it, you still have to follow the guidance itself.
Okay. We do have a few attendees that have questions about quantifying remedy sensitivities. One of the attendees just wonder if you are aware of published studies that show historical sensitivity of our remedies to weather. They go on to note that it can be difficult to explain the impact of a remedy might be unless information about engineering design and its sensitivity is conveyed to the climate assessment team?
That's a really good question. I have to admit that we've leveraged the expertise we've developed in-house in conducting optimizations, remedy optimizations. So we've been providing support to over 400 sites where remedies have been optimized. And that often requires taking both historic as well as design, as well as regulatory information to direct the decision, picking it apart to figure out what are the key contributors of the remedy to site protectiveness. So we've used that expertise that we've developed over years to be able to pick apart remedies and determine where their protectiveness may be most impaired by these future climate conditions. The discussions that Sean mentioned earlier between the site team, remedy engineers, and climate folks, that's where that conversation takes place. So this part of this discussion today and the CBA hopefully gets us moves as part of the way there. But when we have a subsequent report on the findings themselves, the prevalence of different types of protectiveness issues identified, et cetera, hopefully it will be better prepared to at least share empirically what we have been finding. Site specifically, it's going to be a conversation between the climate team, the remedy engineers, and and the regulatory considerations at the site. Thank you.
Thank you, Carlos. And we had an attendee who shared an example from a Region 1 EPA five-year review template that in that specific Section 5 has a question and a note that the question may address, quote, site changes or vulnerabilities that may be related to climate change impacts not apparent during the remedy selection, remedy implementation, or O&M. For example, sea level rise, changes in precipitation, increasing risk of floods, changes in temperature, increasing intensity of hurricanes and increasing wildfires, melting permafrost in northern regions, et cetera. So it does appear as though this type of language is being adopted and implemented in some of the five-year review templates at EPA regions.
Great. Yeah. And the CBA will help you determine whether there indeed is a site change or vulnerability that wasn't that did not exist before, because it'll help you contrast historic conditions versus projected future conditions. That's exactly the purpose of this of the CBA issue. Thank you.
All right. I do want to just issue a call here. If you have a question or comment, now is the time to go ahead and type that into the Q&A. I am going to go back to a question we received earlier as we wait for some additional questions or comments that have come into the queue. This one is asking about RCRA. So one of the attendees wanted to know if you know whether the RCRA portfolio has already been assessed for vulnerabilities, for example, at their corrective action sites. So is RCRA doing work like this?
There is definitely a lot of work, and I will not speak for them. I'll tell you what I know about it and maybe point you to a person that might be able to speak more about it. Maybe they want to do a webinar on it. But I know I'm part of the Olin Climate Adaptation Work Group, and my colleagues from RCRA Corrective Action also participate on that. I know there's a few efforts going underway right now, including policy, a tool to do a screening level assessment of all corrective action sites. And there's actually a GAO inquiry related similar to the one we had in Superfund. So there's a lot going on, but I would mention either Scott Palmer or I'm sorry, I can't, the person's name escapes me right now, in the corrective action program that can help address that question. The other person's from Region 10. I'm sorry, I can't remember your name right now. It'll come to me in just a second. And I'll share it with you. Lisa,
Lisa MacArthur.
Thank you.
Lisa's on, so thank you, Lisa. All right, excellent. And this one gets back to those examples. So we had attendees looking for example CVAs if they were posted, or where they can learn more about site-specific examples or language that's been used. This one is simply asking, do we have any examples of a CVA that has been incorporated at the remedial options analysis stage?
I'm trying to remember if we've, and I'm not sure that's done. I think we have some, right, Sean, that are at the RIFS, but I don't know that we've completed or delivered those reports yet. So I'm sure that within 6 months, we'll be able to be to have some, but I think at this point, we do not have one of how, an example of how a CVA has been factored. In other words, we've completed the CVA, the site team has taken it, and finish their FS process. I don't think we have an example of that. Not that it hasn't happened, at least, but at least in the portfolio of sites that we have, that whole cycle has not been closed yet. Sean, I don't know if there's anything to add to that.
Yeah, not in terms of like following up and knowing exactly what was done, but in some of the discussions, you know, at the beginning, knowing how they plan to use it, at least, yes, in terms of helping to identify you know, different concerns in regards to alternatives. At one specific site, it would be used in terms of helping to negotiate with the responsible party as to why EPA is focusing in on a specific alternative that would be resilient to future climate change, whereas other ones might not be. So, yeah, I think that it would be worth following up with some of these sites. But that was, there's been at least two or three sites that the CVA, I think, has been, really been helpful for the negotiations process, making sure the PRP is on board, because the CVA helped inform, you know, some of the decision making in regards to the analysis that might be preferred at the site.
Yeah, and I'll take that opportunity to mention that we have done CVAs at fund lead, that is when EPA is assuming control and funding of the cleanup, as well as responsible party sites where we're in the oversight mode. And generally, it's been, a CVA is not a go, no go. In other words, it doesn't tell you this remedy is going to work or not work. It informs decisions that relate to the building and operating a remedy. And generally, the conversation that we know site teams have had with responsible parties is not, you're right, I'm wrong. It's more a matter of contrasting what our analyses are. So it provides information. They have a conversation. It's not a matter of proving who is right and who is wrong. And I think so far, the feedback we've gotten is that it's helped create a constructive technical discussion rather than an argument about which model is better.
Okay. I do just want to circle back. Lisa MacArthur was kind enough to chime in with a shared point of contact that if anyone has questions about RECRA and climate change, they can email her directly at macarthur.lisa@epa.gov. I will put that in the public chat for the attendees. And she did also share contact information for her colleague, Scott Palmer, as well. And his email is palmer.scott@epa.gov. So Lisa, thank you for volunteering that people can contact you with their RECRA and climate change questions. I wanted to circle back to those 26 sites where you did CVAs. We had a question asking if they were all fund lead sites.
Yeah, I just mentioned that they weren't. They were not. There are responsible party lead sites amongst them, we are doing a couple of pilots, as I mentioned, at corrective action sites, and as well as public facility sites.
Okay, well, as a result of these. Have you pursued or has EPA pursued adaptations at the PRP lead sites? And specifically, they just wanted to know if the CVA was enough to justify directing PRPs to pay for the adaptations.
I don't have exact, again, these are all pretty recent. You know, one site where negotiations are, I believe they're underway. I'm not sure of the record. I guess the record decision might've been signed because the goal was to sign in September. So I'll have to follow up. I know that, as Sean suggested, it's a site that's in a coastal area. And the question is, how much of the cap, you know, how much waste are we going to need in place, basically? That's a pretty common question at sites that are at the waterline or just above the waterline. How robust is that containment system going to be built, if it's going to be built at all or not. So I know that was an example of a negotiation about how much will leave in place and how robust is the cap. But I don't have and I can't give you an example of site where it's already concluded. I should note that in the profiles that I mentioned earlier on the website, there's an example of an existing site, in this case Pacific Northwest, in Puget Sound, where modifications have been made to an existing remedy to ensure continued protectiveness given signs of climate change and how it's affecting the protectiveness of the existing cap. So please take a look at those profiles that we already have up there. There are good examples of how adaptation is being put in place in response to empirical evidence of erosion, but we don't have any yet based on a CDA and indications of future changes.
Okay. And then one last question. You had mentioned federal facilities, that you've done some at a federal facility site. Can you comment if there are plans for specific guidelines for CVAs at federal facilities? They were wondering if federal facilities are responsible for taking the lead in this type of work.
That's a good good question. So that assessment of consideration of climate change in the CERCLA process is universal. It doesn't matter if it's a fund-lead site, a PRP-lead site, or a federal facility site. That long-term protectiveness applies to everybody. So from that point of view, there's space to have that conversation regardless of who has the lead. However, federal facilities generally, they are investing a lot in the climate modeling, especially on Department of Defense side, because it's mission critical to ensure that they have the continuing operating capability. So they are, there is quite a significant capacity to do climate vulnerability assessments on their side as well. So I think our experience, that's one of the things we're looking forward to doing, is contrasting and seeing how we can be more efficient and what questions we need to ask with respect to the CDAs that we conduct. That's all I would say for now. The current guidance that came out of OzReady did literally say non-federal facility sites, but that was mostly because it was a response to the GAO report, not that the guidance didn't apply to federal facilities, but we are looking at updating that guidance so it's universal to all three site leads. Thank you.
Okay. And Carlos, we did have a colleague on, Jill Branby, who mentioned Jill was kind enough to share her contact information in the chat. And I'm going to put that out there. So if you have Superfund federal facility climate related questions, you can contact Jill Branby at branby.jill@epa.gov. Okay, Carlos, I don't see any more questions in the queue. I do want to turn it back to you. I believe you have one last thing you'd like to do with our audience, and then we'll see if any last minute questions come in before we close things out today. So I'll turn the floor back to you.
Great. Thanks, Jean. So yeah, we do have a bit of what I think Jean calls a knowledge check. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
We've covered a lot of material. Admittedly, we didn't cover what I think a lot of folks were hoping to dive into, which is what are the findings of the CDA. We focus on the CDA process itself, but there are some very important high-level questions that we hope you retain. So we have a series of little pop quiz here to see how we did. The first question is, and sorry, just Gene, are you going to do this on the side, or is this going to be just this version?
Yeah, you know what? I think we've got time. Let's have fun and let's do it the whole way so they can get an actual grade here. So I am going to go ahead and launch these questions, all of them. So Carlos is going to walk us through the responses here in just a moment, but a quiz has popped up. There are 7 questions. They are all true false. And you are asked to read each statement and then indicate if you think it is a true or false statement. And then when you're done, you'll hit the submit button. So I'm going to read these 7 statements. Under CERCLA, there is no need to consider climate change vulnerabilities. True or false? Statement number 2, my site cleanup schedule shows we will achieve unlimited unrestricted site use within 3 years. I should complete a CBA ASAP. True or false? Statement 3, I should be able to task my contractor to perform a CBA. True or false? Now, statement number 4, professional judgment is necessary part of interpreting a CBA report. True or false? Statement number 5, a CVA is a robust method to predict precipitation intensities when extreme storms happen. True or false? Statement number six, CVA analysis generally results in the site team having to change the remedy and issue an amended record of decision, true or false? And last statement, if a climate vulnerability screening is done as part of a five-year review indicates a possible remedy protectness vulnerability, we might require a CVA to be conducted before the next five-year review. Is that true or false? So I'll give you all just a few more seconds to play along again and indicate what you've learned in our session today.
And I'll go if through them for the... For
exactly.
The,
and then we're going to go through these each one at a time. Quite but I'm going to go ahead and lock it down here. About half of the audience has cast their vote. And I know some of you are probably highly analytical like myself and are thinking of all the scenarios that could be a maybe true, maybe false, but just take your best guess, hit a true or false, and then hit submit. And then I'm going to go ahead and end this poll here in 3, 2, 1. All right. So let me share these results. So Carlos, it looks like for statement one under CERCLA, there is no need to consider climate change vulnerabilities. 86% picked false.
All right. That's correct. As I said, long-term protectiveness is clearly stipulated in CERCLA. If we don't consider the future climate conditions and the remedies going to be around that long, we may not be consistent with the CERCLA requirements. Number two, if I'm going to be out of here in 3 years, do I need a CVA? And the responses were, is there a problem? Say this one's a little bit trickier. The intent is a false. In 3 years, climate change is not going to change that much. Your historic records are sufficient. Save yourself the time and use historic records rather than conducting the projection to determine whether you have future climate conditions. So number two is intended to be a false. Number three, should I be able to ask my site contractor to perform a CVA? That is definitely intended for internal audiences. And yes, the CVA paper, issue paper is intended in part to help site teams figure out how do I task a climate vulnerability assessment to be conducted if I don't have the internal capabilities to do that. True. Number four, professional judgment is a necessary part of interpreting a CVA report. This has come up a couple of times, for example, with respect to how do you do climate projections, how do you determine whether protectiveness is an issue, and how do you determine whether adaptation measures are sufficient. So definitely professional judgment is a part of a CVA. A CVA is a robust method to predict precipitation intensities and when extreme storms will happen. Definitely not. This is not a prediction, this is a projection. So CVAs project a range of situations, and we determine, in case Sean has described, we often go with the worst case scenario to make sure that we're covered, but it's not a prediction of when things are gonna happen, it's a projection of the ranges we may face. A CVA analysis generally results in the site team having to change the remedy and issue an amended record of decision. Try to emphasize, generally that is not the case because climate is already considered. And often redundancies are built into remedies. So rarely, we have never seen a situation where the remedy had to change. We have seen situations where we might have to make changes down the road to ensure we continue to have protectiveness. So that's false. We do not necessarily, we have not found that remedy changes are necessary. And finally, the climate vulnerability screening done as a five-year review indicates there might be an issue. Should I request a CVA? Yeah, that's definitely probably a good idea. And with that CBA, you can make an informed decision as to the nature and extent of adaptation measures you may need to implement going forward. Good. I look forward to seeing the results. Hopefully this helped you determine whether you retained some of the information and got the messages. It will certainly help us determine whether we need to improve our communication tools and process. So I think with that, Gene, we're pretty much done. Thank you. I hand it back to you. And Sean, thank you for co-instructing this course. And again, I reiterate my appreciation to all the site teams that have worked with us so far in conducting CVAs. And to all the right. audience, thank you.
Thank you, Carlos. So with that, I'll go ahead and walk through just a few quick final reminders before we close things out today. So as Carlos said, I'd like to echo the thanks to the over 250 individuals who joined us for today's live broadcast, along with our presenters and organizers and all of the technical staff that helped run today's session in the background. I encourage you to visit us at the Cleanup Information Network at cluin.org, and please make sure that you sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct. It goes out on the first of each month, and I'll be highlighting free online training opportunities and other technical publications, such as that engineering issue forum paper in that newsletter. So please be sure to visit us there and subscribe. For those of you who are looking for copies of the presentation material, we have already posted those, as well as the link to the issue paper, links to a number of the other resources that were highlighted in today's session on the seminar homepage. That URL is shown in red. You can bookmark that URL and access it from today forward, and you are absolutely welcome to forward that website to other colleagues. And for those of you who are looking to receive a copy of a participation certificate, I would be happy to issue one, but you'll get one of those after you submit feedback for today's session. So please take a moment to visit us at that seminar homepage shown in red and scroll down to the section on the feedback form. If you fill out that online feedback form, making sure that you check the box at the bottom certifying you were here for the entire delivery, as soon as you submit your feedback, you'll then immediately have a certification a certificate of participation that you can download and print out for your own records. We'll also email a copy to you, but sometimes that gets caught up in junk or spam filters, so I encourage you to download it as soon as you see that on the confirmation screen. If you happen to host a viewing party at your location and had others join you at your location, please send them to that seminar homepage. Each person can fill out that feedback form, even if they didn't register on their own, and get their own certificate of participation for their own records. And with that, I do just want to remind everyone that that seminar homepage is active from today forward. We recorded today's session, and in about 1 week, I'll be sharing a link to the archived version that can be accessed and played back on demand. Now, if you happen to be one of the lucky ones watching the recorded version right now, in that archive, you will see above my head, and this is only for the people watching the recorded version, there will be a button that will point you to the seminar feedback form right from the recording. And you can follow that button or link to the seminar feedback form and fill it out based on your replay of the archive and still get a certificate of participation from viewing the archive session. So with that, again, I want to thank everyone for joining us and actively participating in our session today. We hope that this was a valuable expenditure of your time and that you'll join us on a future Clue in Internet seminar. With that, I will formally conclude today's live session. Thank you so very much for joining us.